Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Thereafter, the Lord entered his palaces, which were perfect to the fullest extent. His wives lived in them, and they numbered over 16,000. Purport. Lord Krishna had 16,108 wives, and for each and every one of them, there was a fully equipped palace, complete with necessary compounds and gardens. Full description of these palaces is given in the 10th canto. All the palaces were made of the best marble stone. They were illuminated by jewels and decorated by curtains and carpets of velvet and silk, nicely bedecked and embroidered with gold lace. The personality of Godhead means one who is full with all power, all energy, all opulences, all beauties, all knowledge, and all renunciation. Therefore, in the palaces of the Lord, there was nothing wanting for fulfilling all the desires of the Lord. The Lord is unlimited, and therefore his desires are also unlimited. And the supply is also unlimited. Everything being unlimited, it is concisely described here as sarva kama, or full with all desirable equipment. I should mention here, if the book you're looking at says samakamam instead of sarvakamam, that's a mistake. If you look back to Srila Prabhupada's original Bhagavatam, which I did, the word that Srila Prabhupada here is sarvakaman, which is, of course, the words from the verse itself. Ata vishat swabhavanam sarvakamam anuttamam prasada yatra patinam sahasrani chashodasha. Thereafter, the Lord entered his palaces, which were perfect to the fullest extent. His wives lived in them, and they numbered over 16,000. So this is the epitome of what we look for in this world. Beautiful homes, not just one, many homes. And a family that's full of love and opulence and beauty. A loving wife for each of Krishna's wives had at least 10 children. So not only a family, we want a loving extended family. Of course, most people don't want 16,108 wives. But some extended family, many, many family members that come together in love, in understanding, in appreciation, a family that's full of joy, a home that's full of opulence, right? Silk and velvet curtains embroidered with gold lace and marble stone, jeweled lamps. We read in the 10th canto how there was so much incense smoke that when it went out of the windows, the peacocks thought that it was clouds and started dancing, anticipating the rain. So this is what we're all desiring. But in this world, trying to fulfill those desires brings us a lot of grief. If we build even one beautiful house, then we have so much grief to maintain it. That the washing machine gets clogged up and there's water all over the floor. The electricity doesn't work. The floorboards come up. The roof leaks. The termites are eating it. We have to pay the taxes on the property, the utility bills. We have to mow the lawn, and the crabgrass is sneaking into the driveway and eating it up, and on and on and on. And our beautiful home gives us comfort, but at a very high price. We have so much anxiety and time and effort to maintaining our beautiful home. And as things do in this world, we've discussed this many times, that the benefits we get, the beauty that we have from our home, after a short time becomes a background. We don't even notice it anymore. So you can have a home with marble floors and gold and silk curtains, with velvet and silk curtains with gold filigree, but after a while, you won't even notice it anymore. It will give you happiness for a while. You admire it. And then it just becomes what there is. And then you want something more. And our families, even in the modern times, people have just one husband, one wife at a time. And just on that one husband and one wife, one set of children, But we are looking for connection, we're looking for love, we're looking for understanding and consideration, and often we get the opposite. We get, you know, someone who blames us, why did you do this, you did that, oh, I'm so sorry, oh, I'm not going to accept your apology. So much grief. And often in our very means, our very attempts to connect with our loved ones, to be close to our loved ones, they become angry and they rebuff us. So we try to make a connection and they say, no, I don't want to connect with you. I don't like you. I'm angry with you. This problem, that problem. So we are trying to fulfill these desires. And there are many more desires. I'm mentioning those two because those are the two here that Krishna has, beautiful homes and a large loving family. But we find that these things bring us a lot of grief. Even if you have a beautiful home that's exactly what you want, and even if you have a wonderful spouse and wonderful children, there's still so much pain. There's still so much pain. I remember my brother-in-law used to sing a song called Kisses Sweeter Than Wine. It was one of his favorite songs. And it was very funny. The song talks about how a man falls in love with a girl and gets married and has children. And then at the end it says, I had a lot of trouble and pain, but I would do it all over again. So this is, of course, our situation, that we have so much trouble and pain, and yet we do it over and over and over again. And so an intelligent person comes to the conclusion that the source of my problems are my desires. That if I didn't care about a beautiful home with gorgeous furniture and floors and decorations, if I didn't want a husband or wife or children, if I didn't care about family and friends, then I wouldn't have any grief. So, of course, this is one of the tenets of Buddhism, that all grief is caused by desires. After all, if you don't want something, it doesn't matter if you get it or not, right? I mean, I have no desire for, a pet leopard. So if I don't get one, there's no grief. There's no meaning to me. And therefore you find that people serious about spirituality from the beginning of time, they have minimized such things as home and family. Many have remained celibate their entire life. Or at least by middle life, they take up celibacy and leave the family. And many have lived in poverty. Right now I'm reading the story of Nala Kuvera, actually listening to the story of Nala Kuvera and Manigriva, Prabhupada dictating the Krishna book. And he talks about how Nala Kuvera and Manigriva, the sons of Kuvera, were very wealthy. And because they were very wealthy, they were addicted to illicit sex, intoxication, and gambling. And he says that wealthy people may even go so far as to kill the poor innocent animals. So this is, of course, our modern society where people are living on the blood and muscle and fat of innocent animals killed horribly in the slaughterhouse, where they are always taking some sort of mind-altering drug, and if not, they're becoming intoxicated with television and movies, where their sexual life is almost always illicit, and where they are certainly engaged in many gambling activities. So these sons of Kuvera who were engaged like this, and due to their pride, Narada Muni cursed them to become trees, fully conscious trees, fully conscious trees. And Prabhupada, noting how their wealth had been the impetus for their degradation, talked about how the brahmanas will often take a vow of poverty. That especially the brahmanas who live on charity, Prabhupada explains many places, that if they get some money, they spend what they need for that day and whatever remains they give away in charity to intentionally keep themselves in a poverty-stricken condition. So my point is that from the beginning of time, religious people, spiritually minded people, have said, let me give up these desires and let me give up the outward way of satisfying these desires. Let me not desire a home and let me give up a home. Let me have no home, like the ghost mummies who had no home. Right? The wandering mendicant, Madhavendra Puri, who had no home. Or let me have a very, very simple home. They'll build a little hut. And we'll live in a cave. And let me have no family. Let me live as a lifetime renunciate. Or let me have very simple family life, which I have only till middle age. So that's there. We're not doubting that that's there as a way of dealing with the miseries of desires. However, just doing that is not sufficient. If you just say, okay, I won't have any home, or I'll have a very simple home, or I won't have a family, or have some very simple family life, just doing that, first of all, will not stop those desires, and second of all, will not get rid of all the miseries. And why is that? We can see here that Krishna has unlimited desires. Therefore, we as part and parcel of Krishna, Mamaivamso Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana, we also have desires. However, in conditional life, Mana Shastra Indriyani Prakriti Sani Karshtiti. We're struggling with the perverted form of these desires. We're struggling with a way of fulfilling these desires separate from Krishna. Sometimes it seems that we have unlimited desires, sarva kaman here. Prabhupada says his desires are unlimited, but you know, I don't think that a jiva can have unlimited desires. Although Krishna does say in the Bhagavad Gita, bound by an unlimited network of desires. Sometimes it seems that our desires are unlimited. But I don't even think, you know, even a very lusty man really would want to take care of 16,000 women. You know, he probably gets satiated after, you know, 100 or 200. But we have all these desires, but they're not really, how do you say, they're not actually the desires of the soul. They're almost a reflection of desire. And therefore, they can't be satisfied. No matter how many desires we have, hundreds and thousands or millions or billions, we don't have the facility, as Prabhupada says here, that we have an unlimited supply to satisfy our desires. And therefore, we are frustrated. And we don't stop to think that the reason that I have so many desires is that my origin must also have so many desires. We think the cure is to kill desires, and therefore we think that the ultimate reality is the reality free from desire. We think the ultimate reality is just Brahman, just peace. Oh, finally, have peace. Peace and just freedom, liberation. And so you find that most of the religions and spiritual followings of the world, they emphasize this salvation. They emphasize liberation. But we who are followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, followers of the Bhagavatam, we know that there is the reality of which this is the reflection. It's compared in the 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita that this world is like a banyan tree, upside down. And Prabhupada says, how is there an upside down banyan tree? Well, there is in the water. And if you jump in the water thinking you're going to climb the tree, you only get wet. So one may think, let me not climb trees. But no, you climb the real tree, not the tree in the reflection. So our understanding is that God is a person and we are persons. He's a person. What does it mean to be a person? You know, it's very interesting that there are some devotees, even some leaders in the Hare Krishna movement, who say that women do not have varna. Varna literally means color. But it Varna, Krishna says, Chatur Varna Mayashvastam Guna Karma Vivagasaha. Guna and karma. That we say someone has Varna because of their Guna and karma. Guna means your qualities, your nature, and karma means the work that fits your nature. So when someone says women don't have karma, I say to them, do you mean that women have no guna? They have no qualities? That every woman is exactly like every other woman? Or do you mean that women do have personality and nature and qualities? They have guna, but they don't have either a need to express those qualities. In other words, they won't have any ill happenstance if they don't express them. They can have qualities without any expression of those qualities, and they'll be perfectly happy. One of the two. Women must have no guna, and therefore no karma related to that guna, or else women must have guna, but there's no need for them to have any expression of their qualities. So, of course, this is patently absurd just by our practical experience, what to speak of Shastra. We see that everyone, not just human men, but every living entity has guna and karma. Every living entity has personality. We just had a wonderful demonstration by Paramahamsa Prabhu at our center here on Sunday of the different types of personalities by a very famous and often used program called Myers-Briggs. And there it shows what each of us have, one of 16 personality types. And then, of course, more and more fine, so each of us have our own particular personality. And the point they make is whatever nature you have, you must express it. Of course, Krishna makes this point also in the third chapter and in the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where he says everyone must follow their nature. He says the choice is do your nature for Krishna, or do your nature for Maya. If you do your nature for Krishna, you'll be happy. If you do your nature for Maya, then everything will be a failure. But you cannot artificially follow someone else's nature, even if you think it's better. And you can't stop being who you are. You can't stop acting according to who you are, what your nature is in this life. So we may think that the ultimate reality has no nature, has no qualities, and therefore no actions. Again, because in this life, my qualities, my personality, my actions are troublesome. If you take one of these personality tests, and I've taken many in different systems, and you read about this is the kind of person that I am, they'll list your strengths and they'll list your weaknesses. And when you read these, you read the list of weaknesses and you say, oh, this, I don't want to be like that. Right? And then you look at all the other personality types, and they all have weaknesses too. You know, I trade one for the other. So we think that the ultimate reality, to be without weakness, must be a reality without personality and without action. But here we see Krishna has personality. He has desires. He has actions to fulfill those desires without inebriety. There's no inebriety in his personality, in his desires, and in his actions. And when we also come to who we really are, some personality test, one's Varna, one's this, one that, in this life, that's not who we really are. We may have to act according to that nature while we're in this body. At least that's what Krishna says. He says, unless you're fully liberated, in which case, you have no reason to act according to that nature, nor any reason not to. But as long as one is conditioned, one has to act according to one's nature. The choice is to do it for Krishna or do it for Maya, that's all. There's no choice not to do it or to do someone else's nature. But it's not my ultimate nature. It hasn't been my nature in every lifetime. One who's a Brahmin in one lifetime may be a Shudra in another. One who's a man in one lifetime may be a woman in another. Right? Even the animals have their nature, what you speak of men and women. Everyone has their particular nature, but I have my ultimate nature. The nature I'm exhibiting, the personality I'm exhibiting in this lifetime, that is as much a temporary in position, as is this body that I have. It's like when you play a role on a stage, and you get not only a costume, but you get a mentality of a character. So we've taken a particular costume and a particular mentality. But just like the Lord, Krishna says, it says in Ishopanishad, rather, like unto the sun, as am I. I have the same qualities of Krishna. So I have an original personality with original desires and original qualities and original and pure, uninebriated, full of light way of fulfilling those desires. So, of course, this fact of our philosophy that the ultimate truth is a person with qualities, with desires, although he's self-satisfied, and with total means of fulfilling his desires, not just desires, unlimited desires. Unlimited desires. Not just one beautiful home, unlimited beautiful homes. I mean, on this earth, 16,108, but ultimately Krishna has unlimited homes. He doesn't just have 16,108 wives. If one of us wants to be Krishna's wife, it's not that he'll say, sorry, I already have my quota, too bad for you. He has unlimited wives, unlimited gopis, unlimited cowherd boys, unlimited desires, unlimited means of fulfilling those desires. So that is a very attractive aspect of our philosophy, the personality of Godhead, the ultimate reality where everything that we want here actually exists in perfection, is something that very much attracts us to taking up the spiritual path. And it should. Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavad Gita, again, I believe it's in the 15th chapter, where Krishna gives a very brief description of the spiritual world, just that it's not lit by sunlight, moonlight, or electricity. One who goes there never returns to this world. Just hearing that description, Prabhupada says one should be captivated by this information. So if we would like to enter into that world, here we're talking about Dwaraka, the city of Dwaras, the city of gates. If we'd like to enter into that city of Dwaraka, to see Krishna's palaces, his beautiful queens, the velvet and silk curtains with the gold filigree, to see Krishna face to face, he who is full with all power, all energy, all opulences, all beauties, all knowledge, all renunciation, who has palaces where there is nothing wanting for fulfilling all the desires of the Lord. Right, if we want to go to Vrindavan, Chintamani, Prakatasadmashu, Kalpaviksha Lakshabhateshu, Sugabhi Ravipalayam Tam, Lakshmi Sahasra Sata Sambhama Sevimanam, Govinda Madhipurisham Tam Maham Vajam. Desire trees, Kalpaviksha, and thousands of goddesses of fortune. So if we want to enter there, what we need to do is understand what is real desires. We have to come back to our position of real desire. So in this regard, we go to Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila, Chapter 4, wherein Krishna Das Kaviraj very beautifully describes the reason for the advent of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That Krishna is the object of love. He is the one who is loved. And Srimati Radharani and all the devotees, they are the abodes of love. They are the lovers. They are full of love. They are giving love to the beloved. He is the central object of love. Of course, the pure devotees, they certainly love each other. It's not that everybody just loves Krishna and then they're cool to everybody else, or they don't have any relationship with everyone else. They certainly all love each other. But with Krishna as the central object of love, so Krishna is the center, as the object of love, and everyone is loving him. And Krishna says that he wants to also experience what it is like to be the abode of love, to have himself as the object of love. He wants to become his own lover. In this way, he repays his debt to Srimati Radharani and the gopis. Right? If I have a debt to someone, that person may want me to fully understand how they feel. So Krishna, to fully understand how the gopis feel, he takes on the color and the mood and the form of Mahaprabhu. And Krishnadas Kaviraj is explaining how this love that Srimati Radharani and the gopis feel for Krishna, that although it looks like ordinary desire, it is not. Why would God want you to feel the desires of this world? And here he explains the difference. Very nice verse. He says, Atmendriya Priti Vancha Tare Bali Kama Krishnendriya Priti Icha Dare Prema Nama. So Atmendriya, Atma, the self, Indriya, senses, Priti, to be dear to. Atmendriya Priti, that is Kama. If I am doing something because it's dear to my senses, that's lust. Krishnendriya Priti Icha Prema Nama. So Krishnendriya, for Krishna's senses, Priti, dear to, Icha, desire. That is Prema. Prabhupada translates that. The desire to gratify one's own senses is lust, but the desire to please the senses of Lord Krishna is Prema. So interesting, of course, that Krishnadas Kaviraj uses the word Kama and Prema in opposition, whereas in today's verse, we have the word kama. Obviously, there's different types of kama or desire. One kind of kama is lust, and another kind of kama is actually prema or love. So if we want to enter into this world of Krishna's kama, then we also have to become like that. Prabhupada says to enter into the fire, you have to be like fire. To enter into the water, you have to be like water. And we have to revive who we actually are. So what does kama mean? To satisfy my senses means, first of all, I see that I am the center. And everyone I deal with, I see as needing to give me something. I am doing things for them because I believe, falsely, that I require something from them. Now, on the most gross and sinful platform, I actually steal something from the other, regardless of the amount of harm it gives the other, and I am callous to their pain. I'm so much in my own desire to satisfy my senses that I take from others as if they are unfeeling objects. So this is, of course, epitomized in meat eating. So in meat eating, a person wants the taste of meat. Of course, you can get the taste of meat with so many vegetarian means. But they want the taste of meat, and therefore they are willing to give so much pain and torture and horrible, horrible. What was done, especially with sun, I mean, maybe when people went out and hunted. But nowadays, when animals are raised for slaughter and their entire life is just suffering, crowded conditions, artificial drugs and artificial food that they would never eat, being in a place that has no light and being punched and kicked and, you know, sometimes ground up alive, unbelievable. The tortures that are being done to animals simply so they can provide food or leather, it's actually, even to think about it, it disturbs one's whole body. But this is a very gross form of lust. Meat eating is an extremely gross and extreme form of lust. Another extreme form of this lust is rape. So, okay, here's some attractive woman. I want to enjoy her and have power over her, and I'm just going to take it. And it doesn't matter if, you know, I father an illegitimate child. It doesn't matter if I give her some disease. It doesn't matter if she's shamed and her family and the community she's in then stones her to death. It doesn't matter if she's publicly humiliated. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter her emotional scars. I got what I want. Another example, of course, is stealing. You know, somebody has something for my senses, and it doesn't matter what kind of pain and suffering they will experience by losing it, but I will simply take it, and I'll take it by force. So although those are very extreme examples, meat-eating, rape, and stealing, Really, all material lust is exactly like that. The difference is that we make some attempt, if we're civilized, to get the cooperation of the other person. Right? We're still trying to get people to give us things for our own desires, but we're trying to get the other person to do it willingly. So we make some sort of a contract. We make a contract with our employers, we make a contract with our spouses, with our friends. It may be a written contract, it may be a verbal contract, it may be an unspoken contract, maybe unspoken understanding. And we're willing to pay something for it. I'm willing to do something on my end. I'm not just going to take it. So I make a contract with you, and I'm going to give you something for your senses also. But lust means that I want the balance a little bit in my favor. You know, if I think it's totally even or I think the other person is getting more, I become angry. My relation with the other person is basically about what they can do for me. So that is lust. And that is the source of our suffering. It's not the fact that I have a desire. It's not even because I have a desire to be happy. It's not that because I have a desire to be happy, because I properly listen to your beauties, knowledge, renunciation, power, energy, opulences. It's not exactly because I desire power, beauty, energies, opulences, etc. In one sense, there's nothing wrong with desiring them. They're part of who I am as a soul. The problem is that I think that I'm the center, and the way to get them is for other living entities to give me what they have. That's the problem. Prabhupada compares this, of course, the Shastra also compares this to a body or a tree. Now, there's no problem with the body being energized. But there's a problem if you try to put the food that gives you energy into your ear instead of into your mouth. That's a problem. Or if you try to put the food into your eyes. So if you're trying to put the food into your eyes, and then your eyes have so much pain and are diseased, the problem is not the food. And the problem is not wanting the food, and the problem is not putting the food into a hole in the body. The problem is simply which hole you put it into. What was your method? And as soon as you put food into your mouth, then your eyes, if it's healthy food, your eyes will also be healthy. So lust means I'm trying to give the benefit directly to myself rather than to Krishna. That's basically lust, as Krishnadas Kaviraj explains. So if I want to enter into Krishna's pastime, the switch I have to make is very small. The effect is huge, but the switch is small. What I would normally do, yat karoshi yat ignasi yat chahosi yadasi yat yat tapasvisi kante yat takshu shraman arpanam, whatever I would normally do, except for the grossly sinful, non-reciprocal taking. That I can't kill animals and rape and steal and do that for Krishna. That I can't do. But any normally reciprocal things that I do in this world, that I can do for Krishna. I can do to make Krishna happy rather than to make me happy. And of course, because I'm part of Krishna, if I make Krishna happy, then I automatically become happy. And at a certain point, I lose even any thought to my own happiness. I don't need to. I don't need to think about my own happiness. Just like if you work for a good company, you don't need to worry about your salary. You're just focusing on the work you're doing. You're not focusing on whether or not you're getting paid, and you're not always thinking, I'm doing this to get paid. I mean, I've been involved in some wonderful devotional projects where I didn't have to think at all about where I would sleep or what I would eat. I could just give my full 100% energy to the project, and the leaders took care of me. It was not a motive to think of myself. So we've all had this experience to some degree or another. And this is what we need to practice. When we say sadhana bhakti refers to some external physical behaviors, such as having your mouth say the Hare Krishna mantra, right, 16 times 1,728 every day, and saying the Gayatri mantra, and worshiping the deity, and offering your food. It involves those physical behaviors, undoubtedly. But really, what practice boxing means is switching who's at the center. You know, I'm not really good at being at the center anyway. First of all, nobody else thinks I'm the center except for me. There's not one other person in this world who thinks I'm the center. I'm the only one thinking I'm the center. So, you know, it's probably not true. And it doesn't work very well, my being the center. You know, people aren't really very cooperative with making me the center because they think they're the center. And if somebody temporarily is some sort of hallucination that I'm the center, I don't like that either. You know, if somebody comes to me, and I've had a few people, not many, do this in my life, you're everything to me, Ormila, it becomes disgusting. You know, if someone comes to me and says, oh, you're my mother, my father, my beloved, my child, my friend, I'm thinking, I can't supply this person with everything they need. You know, then I just think about that old Bob Dylan song, It Ain't Me, Babe. As soon as somebody actually asks me to play God, I withdraw. I feel, I can't do that for you. I don't have the means. I don't have the means for you to drink me unlimitedly. I can't supply like that. If I try, I will become very quickly depleted. So it isn't working. I'm not happy being at the center. I'm not feeling nourished. Just get myself out of the center and admit that I'm in one of the circles around Krishna. That's all. It's a very simple thing. It's not hard to do. Of course, Prabhupada says simple to say and hard to execute. Hard to execute because we have a long-standing habit. But we can examine our relationships with others. Am I saying this or doing this to get something from someone, especially to try to force somebody to give me something that they don't want to give me? Or am I getting what I need from Krishna, and therefore my relationship with this other person is on the platform of freedom? They can give me or not. It doesn't matter. I'm getting my respect from Krishna. I don't need Amani Namani Dana. I don't need respect from anyone else. I don't even care for it. I see it as something that distracts me from my relationship with Krishna. I'm getting all my understanding and consideration and connection with Krishna. I don't need it from anyone else. If they give it to me, I rejoice. If they don't, it doesn't matter. I can celebrate whatever connection and love I have with others as the mercy of the Lord. And I also celebrate whatever disconnection and disrespect I get from others as the mercy of the Lord. Right? Whatever Krishna arranges for me in this world, whatever, it doesn't matter because I have with Krishna everything that I need. So by practicing this change of consciousness, then we can also enter into the world which is full of desires. It's genuinely full of desires, and it's also full of the means for fulfillment of those desires. But those desires are all selfless love, and all the means are also selfless love. There's no inebriety and no exploitation. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Any of you have any questions or comments?
Okay, Prabhupada, if there's any questions or comments for those on free conferencing, press star 6. To remain muted or to become unmuted. Anything from anyone?
Oh, another great class.
Oh, I'll ask you a question. About following our nature, you're talking about how one will naturally follow the inclinations of his own nature, our own sort of karmas and gunas. We saw a great example of that with Dhruva Maharaj when Narada Muni tried to instruct him initially, sort of tested him and said, you know, you're just a young boy, better to go home and frolic and play and think, come back when you're older. Things that happen to us are just a result of past activities, etc. But he said, no, I'm a Kshatriya. Even though it's good instruction, I can't follow it. And so Narada, he sort of passed Narada's test. And we saw how strong he held to his Kshatriya nature. But yet with Arjuna, who is also an incredible Kshatriya, we saw that what would appear to fall short of the nature of a Kshatriya. And Krishna had to instruct him to fight. He became inclined to walk off of the battlefield and not be concerned with gaining land. And it seemed he fell short of that nature. So how will we understand that? Was that simply, you know, Krishna putting him under his yoga maya so that the Bhagavad Gita could be spoken, or what was going on there?
Well, Prabhupada tells us that it was definitely Krishna putting Arjuna under yoga maya so Bhagavad Gita could be spoken. But let's look a little bit at this. The ultimate nature of a kshatriya is to protect, is compassion. A kshatriya is not spending the bulk of time on the battlefield. Kshatriya is spending the bulk of time redistributing the taxes of the citizens for the benefit of the citizens, engaging that tax money in jagya, making sure there's schools, hospitals, roadways, resting places, gardens, water supply, ample food supply, full employment, making sure that the weaker members of society are protected, the cows, the women, the brahmanas, the old men, making sure that people are following the laws of God as given by the brahmanas. So the main mood of a kshatriya is compassion and care. That's the main quality of a kshatriya. And you have this sort of compassion and care, not just, you know, for one sick puppy, but for a whole society, requires also that a kshatriya have a nature of Ishvara above. Actually, if I'm going to consider that I have to care for thousands of millions of people, then I have to have the ego that it's my responsibility to do so. And that if I don't do so, that it's a deviation from Dharma. Now, I can't just say, well, you know, whatever, it's their karma, whatever they get. I have to feel that I'm the one who is responsible to do that for them. So part of Arjuna's wanting to walk away from the battle is, as a kshatriya, he had a natural sense of compassion. And after all, as his brother Yudhishthira, being the technical emperor still, although that position was usurped by Duryodhana, everyone on that battlefield was part of Arjuna's responsibility to care for. So he was concerned for caring for the men who would be killed, for the animals, for the women who would be left without husbands, sons, or fathers to protect them, for how this would degrade society, because again, this is the business of a kshatriya. The business of a kshatriya is that they have to make sure that the rules and the traditions that protect and uphold society are continued, that things don't become degraded. That's their job. So what happened to Arjuna was not that he stopped acting like a kshatriya. Not at all. In fact, he was acting completely like a kshatriya. The problem was that he was using his kshatriya nature in a way that wasn't pleasing to Krishna. Because although a kshatriya is primarily enjoined to protect the citizens and to care for them and to give them all material and spiritual facility, a kshatriya sometimes has to engage in violence to achieve that end. So we can all understand this, that in order to have peace in even a small city, there has to be a police force who's willing to arrest and incarcerate criminal elements. That has to be there. And if there's going to be an invading political party who's going to exploit the citizens and not take care of them, so then you're going to fight against that. I read something, where did I read it? Must have been, we get the local paper here on the weekend, must have been something I glanced at there, where some woman who married a man who'd been married before, and the man's first wife had killed all their children. She had been put in a mental hospital for some years. And now the doctors had certified that she was cured, and the man went back to his first wife and took with him the child from his second marriage. I hope you can follow all that. So here a woman is saying that her child is living with that child's father and stepmother, and the stepmother had previously murdered her own children. And she was appealing to the court that my children should not be put in the care of a woman who's already murdered her children. So kshatriya also has to feel like that. If there's going to be a king or a leader who's not going to take proper care of the citizens, then it's the duty of that kshatriya to conquer that kingdom. It's not that the Kshatriya wants wealth and land for his own personal enjoyment. Not a proper Kshatriya, maybe a demoniac Kshatriya, but a actual Kshatriya in Varnashram. You have to remember that real Varnashram means not just a particular kind of work, but a kind of work done as Jagya. So a proper Kshatriya, the reason he's conquering other kingdoms is if he sees that these other kings are not taking good care of their citizens. And therefore, he wants to give the citizens proper care. If he wants to gather wealth, it's to use for the benefit of the citizens, to care for the citizens. Just like an ordinary family man may want to build an addition onto his house in order to take better care of his children, or a family man may take on children as foster children because the families that are taking care of them are not doing a proper job. But the difficulty Arjuna had is that he forgot that he was to do all that as Jagya. He started thinking, I'm to do all this so that people will be happy with me, so that I'll enjoy. He was saying, you know, I'm not going to get any happiness out of this. He said, even if I win, how am I going to enjoy a kingdom tainted with blood? What, he said, just, you know, if I'm going to end up killing my own relatives. I'm going to kill the people that I'm sworn to protect. I'm going to kill the people who are near and dear to me. What kind of pleasure is that? And I'm going to get sin. He was thinking about himself. You know, I'm going to get sin. I'm going to go to hell by destroying family traditions. So he said, okay, let me do one aspect of my Kshatriya duty because it will be the one that will please me the most. And Krishna said, no, you have to work as a Jagya. And when working as a Jagya, Yajnartar Kamano Natra Loho Yam Karma Kamabandana, Tadartam Karma Kanteya Mukti Sangha Samantra. When working as a Jagya, you should be offering for the Yajna Purush. Bhoktaram Yajna Tapasam. I am the enjoyer of all of your tapasya, all of your sacrifice, Arjuna. You're not the enjoyer of your sacrifice. Work to please me. And Krishna is saying, what will please him was a different aspect of Kshatriya Dharma. He said, right now, the kind of Kshatriya Dharma I want you to do is to kill these people, not to take care of them. In fact, he says that is the way to take proper care of them. They'll get better bodies, and the citizens will be prosperous both materially and spiritually under the care of Yudhisthira. Under Duryodhan, there's no indication that they were not prosperous materially, but they could not be prosperous spiritually because Duryodhan would not direct people towards the ultimate goal of life. So therefore, Krishna was telling Arjuna, look, you know, your choice is not whether or not you're going to be a Kshatriya. Your choice is whether or not you're going to be a Kshatriya for me. And being a Kshatriya for me means doing your duty in the way that I want you to do it, and doing it for my pleasure. So Dhruva Maharaj was certainly in the mood of being a Kshatriya for himself. Because after all, if you're a Kshatriya, if you have Ishwar above, then you have to have a certain kind of, how shall we say, pride that comes along with that. I am responsible. This is my responsibility. It's natural. It's a natural result of the mode of passion. Of course, a Vaishnava who is a Kshatriya, who's acting as a Kshatriya, doesn't have that sort of mentality. But someone who's not a devotee, or not a pure devotee like Dhruva was at the time, so his mood is, I'm the controller. And therefore, a person like that reacts very heavily to being insulted. It's natural. If you don't have some sense of ownership and proprietorship and responsibility about something, then an insult regarding that thing is like water off the duck's back. It just doesn't matter. Like we have a neighbor here who did something really crazy with their fence, that they put up a new fence, but the gate is where there's grass, and where the driveway is, it's just a fence. So they have to drive on the grass to get into their house now. And if you say to me, well, your neighbors did something foolish, that wouldn't offend me because I have no responsibility for it. But if you criticize something that I have responsibility for, you know, then immediately I become offended. So Dhruva was criticized for something that was his area of responsibility. He was criticized that you're not a fit Kshatriya, you're not a fit ruler. You don't deserve to sit on the lap of your father. You don't deserve to be the king. So he felt very offended. But that was, of course, materialistic.
Oh, wonderful answer. Thank you very much. I really deepened my understanding of what went on in the Bhagavad Gita. That was very helpful.
Anybody
I
else?
Second the motion. Yeah, it was good.
Hare Krishna, Mataji.
Yes?
I just had a question about, along the lines of what you just talked about, in relation to Vanashram and engaging our nature. To what degree should we, because we're trying to understand that we're not the body, and at the same time we're trying to engage the body according to our nature, and to a certain degree identify with that material nature that we have. So how do we, aside from following the process seriously, how do we sort of draw that line in between I'm a spirit soul and I'm acting according to my nature?
Have you ever been in a drama?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Were you ever in a Krishna conscious drama?
No.
Never a Krishna conscious drama.
No.
Well, let's pretend that the drama you were in was actually a Krishna conscious drama. If you could just try to imagine that for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
So just like Janmashtami's coming up and my daughter-in-law is organizing, she's actually written a script for a Krishna conscious drama based on Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha. So in Manashiksha, the mind, the sadhaka bhakta, to whom Raghunath Das Goswami is speaking to, the mind, has to go through several obstacles in order to attain prema. So he has to go through the obstacle of prajalpa, which is represented by a prostitute, the desire for liberation, which I think is represented by a tiger, also, I don't remember all of them, pride, which is represented by a chandala woman, something which is represented by donkey urine. Anyway, different things. So somebody has to play the tiger. Somebody has to play the prostitute, somebody has to play the chandala woman, etc. in the play, in order to glorify Raghunath Das Goswami and glorify Krishna and glorify the process of Krishna consciousness. So let's say you're in a play. I mean, I used to be in the Ramayana. I used to have to play Sherpanika. Not a very nice part to play. But without a Sherpanika, there's no story. Without a Ravana, there's no story. Now, when you're in the drama, it's your duty, it's your service to take on not just the makeup and the costume of the character, but to portray the character very accurately. That's your duty. That's your service. So when you're playing Ravana, when you're playing Sherpanika, when you're playing the tiger, you want to be convincing. And in order to be convincing, you have to empathize with that mentality. But that doesn't mean you become Ravana, or you become a tiger, or that you forget, like we used to have Lokamangala play Ravana. It's not that he forgot he was Lokamangala. I mean, he was a good Ravana. And your mentality is, I'm doing this to please the devotees and to please Krishna. I'm playing this role to please the devotees and to please Krishna. Therefore, you remain, Prabhupada explains this very nicely, Bhagavad Gita 14:22. You remain neutral. All right, I've gotten this body and this psychology because of my own past sinful desires. Highest sinful, you know, all degrees of sin ultimately. So due to my past pious or sinful desires, due to my behavior separate from Krishna, maybe even due somewhat to some devotional service in a past life, who knows. Anyway, however, I have this body and this mind due to my own desires, my own actions, which were foolish. If I was intelligent, I wouldn't have this body and mind at all. But okay, it's what I've got. And at least this body and mind, what Prabhupada calls our psychophysical nature, because it's human, it is a fit vehicle. I believe it's Lord Kapila Dev says that although this, no, it was Prahlad Maharaj, sorry. Paladmara says that the human body, although temporary like others, it's a means to attain Krishna consciousness. So I do my duties exactly like a dramatic artist on the stage is engaged in a play to satisfy the devotee audience. Exactly like that. I try to do it first class in a way that is convincing. At the same time, I know that it's a costume and makeup and a character, and it's not me. And as one progresses in Krishna consciousness, one should start cultivating the inner life. One should start cultivating, meditating on Krishna and Vrindavan, and as one's eternal identity awakens, one starts cultivating internally a meditation on that internal identity. Rupa Goswami gives the example that if a woman has an illicit lover, that she's very careful in her household duties, but her meditation is on when will she have her next clandestine meeting with her lover. So exactly like that. I have a particular body in mind. It has to work in a particular way. It's designed in a particular way, and it's going to work in that way. It just is. That's how it's programmed. That's how it's designed. So my choice with my body in mind, I have two choices, to do it for Krishna or do it for Maya. I guarantee we are all already acting according to our nature. We have to. So my only question is, am I doing that for Maya or for Krishna? If I'm doing it for Krishna, why am I doing it for Krishna? Because I am a soul. And this body and mind, however much it is the gross manifestation of my sinful desires, it is also Krishna's energy. So I may be imprisoned because I committed a crime, but the prison is still the government's property. Therefore, I can start using the aspects of the prison to become a good citizen. I can take courses in the prison. I can teach the other prisoners, etc. So when I realize that this nature that I have, not only my body but my mind, although due to my past sins, although they are the manifestation on a gross platform of my sinful thoughts and desires and actions, it is still belongs to Krishna. Krishna is the one who's given me this vehicle, and the way to get out of it is to use that for his service. By using it in his service with the mentality that it's Krishna's, and I, as separate from the body and mind, are using it in his service. And, of course, my basic sadhana bhakti, which is the most important, much more important than varnashram stuff, but then I will naturally awaken who I am. And then one will live in a kind of non-dual duality. One will live, have an internal life of service to Radha Krishna in Braj, and one will live an external life, seemingly as a sadhaka. But the external life will also be an expression of one's internal feelings of service. They will not be in conflict with one another. All right, thank you very much. I think we should end here unless somebody else has a really pressing question.
Anybody else have a
question? Actually, I do. I actually have a question. I'd just like to see how you handle it.
Okay.
Okay. And I've been hearing this for years. So I know it's circulating. It's part of the movement, you know. And I can understand on one level it's to encourage everyone. But, you know, it's a peculiar thing that I, even a friend of mine that worked in L.A. In the museum project, you know, he told me this, that Srila Prabhupada promised his disciples that if you follow the four regular principles and chant your 16 rounds, that you will go back to Godhead in this lifetime.
Okay.
Could you say something about that?
I can quote Srila Prabhupada. And what is the meaning of the 10 kind of offenses? And I was just reading the prayers of Queen Kunti, where she's talking about Akinchana Gotra, that one must cry to the Lord with sincere feeling. And Prabhupada says that someone who's materially satisfied, there's no quality to their chanting. So you'll find that in most initiation ceremonies, when Prabhupada was personally present, he spoke about the 10 offenses. And of course, he gave us a nectar of instruction where we read about one of the items that can hamper bhakti is niyamagraha. So my reply would be, yes, what Srila Prabhupada said is true. If you just chant 16 rounds and follow the four related principles, at the end of this life, you will go back to Godhead. At the same time, just chant 16 rounds, does that mean that I'm moving my fingers over a set of japa beads while my mouth is making some sounds? Does it mean that I'm abstaining from illicit sex, but actually there's still so much lust in my heart that I hate all the women in the world and I'm cruel to my own wife because I consider them responsible for my lust? Is that what it means? Does it mean that my austerities harden my heart and that my rituals are superficial and merely rituals? Prabhupada was asked here in Hawaii, is it faster to make advancement if you live in the temple rather than living outside? Prabhupada said, that depends on whether or not his mind is on another subject matter. So I would say that's true. Certainly what Srila Prabhupada says is true. At the same time, there is a matter of quality. And if one does those things with quality, then certainly Krishna will fulfill the promise of his devotee and will, as Prabhupada says, drag us to complete success. Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And of course, even if one does those things superficially and offensively, one will be brought to complete success, but not probably in one life. So Prabhupada also, I believe this was also in Hawaii, and may even be in the same conversation, where Prabhupada was saying, what is the meaning of the 10 kinds of offenses? If one commits sin on the strength of chanting, that is the worst offense. He said, and then the devotee said, Prabhupada, should they stop chanting? Prabhupada said, no, we'll be effective, but after a long time. He said, maybe 700 verses will be effective. Or that Nittai, who blasphemed Bhakti Siddhanta, Prabhupada said he will not attain prema for 10,000 lifetimes. So if we put a wrench into the works, if we follow superficially, but we don't actually follow being kind to the devotees and trying to mold our consciousness, then it may take a long time. It will still work, but it will take a long time. Prabhupada compares it to trying to cook with smoke. So if you have a fire that's just smoke and you have a pot on top of it, you know, it's going to take a long time for that water to boil and your beans to cook. If the water's not going to start boiling until all the water, this is Prabhupada's analogy, until all of the water is out of the wood. And when all the water is out of the wood, then the fire can be blazing. So it is part of our process of chanting 16 rounds and following the four related principles to act in such a way that we're not pouring any additional water on the wood. If we're not pouring any additional water on the wood, then the process itself will dry out the wood, and very soon the fire will be blazing. The main way we can pour water on the wood is by offensive devotion.
Yeah, I actually heard mad elephant offense is could destroy the whole garden.
Yes. I'm sure there's other answers. I'm not saying that that's the only answer, but that's my understanding. Because when Prabhupada said that, he, you know, we could talk about the initiation vows. As far as I can see, all of the vows exist on a continuum. When we say chanting 16 rounds, the lowest level of the continuum is that I say the Hare Krishna mantra with my mouth, you know, a certain number of times a day, 17, 28 times 16. That's the lowest level of following. And the highest level of following is that I say the mantra at least that many times absorbed in prema. And then there's everything, a continuum in between. You know, and it's the same with food. You know, the lowest level is I'm just a vegetarian. And the next level is I offer my food. And the next level is I only offer food that's cooked by devotees. You know, or I only offer food in a proper ceremony. I just don't say Sri Vishnu or something. You know, I actually put it on a special plate. And there's all sorts of levels of food and all sorts of levels. I only use first-class ingredients. I mean, there's a continuum. So you can say the person at the bottom level, they're following. They're not eating meat, fish, or eggs. And then the person at the top level, they're eating food only cooked by first-class Pukka devotees, offered with proper ritual, offered with love, cooked with love, maybe grown in your own garden, you know, really first-class, pure items. So that's the topmost level. And we could look at the same thing for intoxication. You know, if you're watching television, is that any kind of intoxicant? Well, probably, although not technically speaking. And gambling, and certainly there's levels of sex, you know, well, I just have sex with my wife and my husband. Or I'm really just having sex only as a yajna with love. So I see that all the five vows, they have levels, and there's the bottom level at which you can say, okay, I'm following my vows, and that's all right. But the devotees should always try to be making an effort to go higher in their progress. And then Krishna will help. Krishna will reciprocate, and he'll make sure the Prabhupada promises is fulfilled.
Thank you. Though sincerity has to be there.
Sincerity and a real effort to make upward progress in each of those vows. You know, a real effort, whatever the vows, the 16 rounds, the intoxication, gambling, meat eating, illicit sex, you know, there's, you know, you might have been celibate for 20 years, but do you think about it? Are you interested in prophet adoration and affliction? Do you want members of the opposite sex to be attracted? You know, there's always ways in which we can go higher and broader and deeper and in a more meaningful way. My own conviction, my own faith, and I can't say this is someone else's faith, but my faith, is that if we're continually, and I use the word continually, not continuously, intentionally, I have a very purposeful choice of words in distinguishing between continuously and continually. If we continually strive to go deeper, to make our vows more and more meaningful, to make my time with my rounds more meaningful time, to make my time with no illicit sex, no meat eating, no intoxication, no gambling. I mean, how am I eating? Even if I'm proud, oh, I only eat devotee cooked prasadam. You know, even if I've got all the externals down, what's my mood? Am I serving Krishna by eating it? Am I honoring the prasadam? Am I relishing his mercy and his grace and his kindness upon me, a wretched, undeserving soul? Or am I just thinking, wow, this tastes good? You know, that's nice flavor and texture for my nose and tongue and belly. You know, what level? So my point is one can always go deeper. And if we're always trying to do that in all of those aspects, which we could call that, we could label that as sincerity. I'm constantly trying to improve. I'm constantly trying. I never think, okay, now I've done it. Now I'm changing my 15 rounds, following principles. Okay, Prabhupada's taking me back to Godhead. Done deal. Then surely Krishna and Prabhupada will be kind. What is the question? Somehow or other, you know. I mean, looking at me, I don't know how they're going to do it. Doesn't seem possible to me. Looks to me like I got Bhagavanam Janmanam Mante. But, you know, just going to follow. Let's follow our master like a little puppy dog.
Thank you, Prabhupada.
Let's be the dog of the Vaishnava. Okay, I need to get going. Happy Ekadasi to everybody. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Hare
Krishna.
All right. Prabhupada.
Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.